Welcome to today's SNEB webinar, sponsored by the Nutrition Education for Children's Division. My name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Executive Director of SNEB and glad you're joining us for our presentation today. A little housekeeping to get us started. If you look in the GoToWebinar tool panel, the handout, the slides for today's presentation are there for you to download. So you're encouraged to do that and follow along with the presentation. We will take questions at the end of the presentation, so please type those in the question block so we can moderate questions to our presenter. When I close the webinar today, there'll be a short survey, and we appreciate your feedback on this session as well as ideas for future webinars. And then watch for an email. We'll probably try to get that out by the end of the day on Monday with a link to the recording, the handout, and the CEU certificate that you're earning for your attendance today. So I'd like to introduce our moderator. Dr. Georgiana Mann is assistant professor at the University of Mississippi and is the immediate past chair of the Children's Division.
Hi, thank you, Rachel. I wanted to introduce y'all to Barbara. Dr. Barbara Lowes is a registered dietitian, professor of health sciences, and head of the Wegman School of Health and Nutrition at the Rochester Institute of Technology in Rochester, New York. In addition, she is the program director of the graduate program in the health and well-being management at RIT. Prior to being at RIT, she was a research professor at the Pennsylvania State University. She received a PhD in nutritional sciences and educational psychology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dr. Lowe's research has focused on development and evaluation of nutrition education for low-income persons and for school-age youth, nutrition behavior instrument validation and testing, especially related to eating competence and the SATA division of responsibility in feeding. Thank you very much. You can go ahead and start.
Thank you very much, Georgiana. I really appreciate it. I'm assuming that everybody can hear me and see the slides, and if there's anything otherwise, I'm assuming somebody will tell me. So I'm going to go ahead and get started. First of all, I want to indicate that I have no conflicts of interest to disclose and that some of this research was actually funded by SNAP-Ed when I was at Pennsylvania State University and the Department of Human Services at Pennsylvania. Here I have the learner objectives. You can read through them yourself, but basically we're looking at a lot of trying to understand the division of responsibility, how you validate a survey, and the relationship then between what we found in the survey and how you measure child nutrition risk and for the following the division of responsibility in feeding. These are the nutrition educator competencies that this presentation fulfills. Looking at the nutritional behavioral needs of the population and to analyze, evaluate, and interpret nutrition education research and apply it to practice. In SNEB, we are using these educator competencies to have all of our presentations and our publications show that we are adhering to these and to show what a nutrition educator actually can do. So I'd like to start off by showing that I think perspective is very important. If you are trying to use this perspective to be able to describe the sky, you would probably say that the sky isn't very big, that there's little pieces of it showing through these leaves, and there's little strips of it. If you were instead to look at this picture, you would say the sky is really much, much bigger than the leaves. And I think that when you're involving child feeding, the perspective is very important. The SATA Division of Responsibility in Feeding actually has a perspective that is broader than a lot of the other perspectives that are used in child feeding. And that's what I want to talk to you about. It's an important perspective, and we felt that it was very important to have it be able to be measured. So I know some of you, especially in the child division, know the SATA Division of Responsibility in Feeding. But just to summarize, there are two balances, the leadership and autonomy. The leadership is that the parent determines the feeding context. In other words, what is served, when it is served, and the environment in which it is served. They have leadership responsibilities. Autonomy is that the child actually determines what they eat from what is served and how much, if any, that they eat. And the division of responsibility is actually the basis for WIC programs, many of the USDA feeding programs. The instrument that I'm going to discuss today has 12 items. It's the SDOR from 2 to 6 years. It has 12 items, and each item has 5 response options, always, often, sometimes, rarely, and never. And rarely and never are scored the same, because if you rarely do something, it's pretty similar to never doing something. The survey has a reading grade level of 2.8 and a reading ease of 95%. If you're interested in using the SDOR, there's a website here where you can apply to use it, explain how you're going to use it, why you're using it, and what your understanding is of the division of responsibility. I encourage you to apply if you're interested in using it. There are a lot of things out there that talk about child feeding, and this is something that was just newly released. And I will say that it has a lot of really nice recommendations in there, a lot of really good information. But a lot of the things are not congruent, really, with the SATR division of responsibility. And for example, in this approach, they have a guideline that says, help kids learn to identify and listen to their hunger or fullness cues, and talk to kids about how their stomach feels before, during, and after eating. This is really not at all congruent with the division of responsibility in feeding. Children have different ways of experiencing fullness, and asking children to think about how full they are while they're eating is kind of like trying to teach a fish how to swim. You have to trust. Children know when they have had enough, and they don't really need somebody interfering with their enjoyment of the meal by asking them how their stomach feels before they eat, during they eat, and after they eat. So I'm just bringing this up as an example of there are many programs and things out there that kind of straddle the paradigm. They have some features of the division of responsibility, but not all. And one of the important things about the instrument, the SDOR 2-6, is that it measures all of the components of the SATR division of responsibility in feeding. If you want to know more, you can go to this website here, and there are lots of materials on the Ellen SATR website to learn more. So I'm going to talk about how we developed this instrument and go through some of the phases. A couple things I'd like to point out is that this took a long time. If you can see, we actually started out in 2009 in the foundational phase, so 12 years. It really developing an instrument that is really valid, that's reliable, that is usable, feasible, sustainable, takes a lot of time. And we went through all of these phases, starting out with 38 items, and now we're down to 12 items, over time by interviewing people, by administering surveys at the appropriate time. And so, for example, we ended up then in the launching phase where we have 15 items that we knew people understood, that when they described why they answered the way they did, it made sense. There was a response option mapping. And finally, in the launching phase, we felt really good about this, but we did even 10 more cognitive interviews with low-income women just to make sure that these 15 items had the level of face validity that we wanted to work with. This is a chart just showing how items came, items went, and it's kind of interesting, too, that we actually removed 14 items that are items that a lot of times people think is pretty appropriate for having in a survey, such as I worry that my child is too fat, or I worry that my child eats too much. Those items did not have face validity or content validity when we tested them. So these are an example of some of the items that were removed. And give you an example of why. For example, the item, between meals, I let my child eat whenever she or he feels like eating. There were response mapping reviewed a lot of problems. Parents actually underreported that doing this on the survey. I enjoy family meal times. This was a very non-discriminating answer, And most of the parents answer always. And then when we interview them, they complain of the child's negative mealtime behavior. Another one, I feel my child's weights are good. This was confusing to the parents. In fact, what it really tested was what the doctor said, what the doctor told the parents when they gave us their responses of why they said this. They said, well, my doctor says it's good, or my doctor says it's not good. It wasn't what the parents felt. So here's a sample of an item that evolved after cognitive interviewing. We had the foundational phase was, I don't let my child eat as much as she or he wants. And then went into the next phases based upon interviews. If I think my child has eaten enough, I try to get him or her to stop. And a lot of times these revisions were done with words that the participants actually use. Then it was revised to, I let my child eat until she or he gets full. And then finally in the launching phase, I let my child eat until she or he stops eating and doesn't want more, which became a very important component of that question. All in all, there was only one item that made it through. My family has meals at about the same times every day. There were a couple of items that were carried through from the refinement phase, but there are also items I'm pointing out that were reverse scored. And one of the reasons is you reverse of the wording of the item so that the parent can agree with it, because it's a lot easier to agree with a behavior than to have to disagree with a behavior. So if I think my child hasn't had enough, I try to get him or her to eat a few more bites. It's a lot easier for the parent to be really honest about that because they can agree with it, as opposed to having them have to disagree with a statement that is against that. So now I'm going to go through and just give you this overview and then go into each one of these separately, the different components that we looked at. First of all, everybody completed a survey, and the survey set included the SDOR as well as some other surveys that we used for construct validity, and I will go over that later. Then we asked people if they wanted to, who had completed the survey, if they wanted to be involved in a dietary assessment. We utilized the Penn State Diet Assessment Center and had parents complete three 24-hour recalls using the Diet Assessment Center protocols. And we also asked people if they wanted to have a family meal videotaped. And so every family meal video that we had and every diet assessment that we had, we also had one of the surveys. The video information was published just recently in the Journal of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. And I'm going to go over a little bit of the information on how we looked at the videos, but if you want more detail, I encourage you to reference this article. Because what we did was we looked at the videos first and to determine, to make sure that we felt good about all 15 items. And then we used the items that remained after the video assessment to actually look at the construct validation. So 117 parents of children who were aged 2 to 5 completed the online survey. 62 of these did the diet assessments, and 20 of them agreed to do the mealtime video capture. The children were about 3 to 4 years of age. Parents were ranged from about 29 to 41 years of age. And we had a variety of family structures. We had some families that had 4 children and some that had only 1 child. 11 of the parents were not at all concerned with their child's weight, and nearly half participated in at least one assistance program. To do the video capture, we did in-home visits ahead of time. We did that to get informed consent. We actually had parents redo the SATR Division of Responsibility scale. We actually used that to compare with their original survey to look at reliability. We also did post-video debriefing, and the pre-visit was involved with staging. We needed to make sure that where would cameras need to be, and you know, were there things that we needed to consider, were there dogs that were going to interfere, that sort of thing. We also made sure that we had informed consent from anybody who was going to be at the meal, including neighbors that might drop over, et cetera. We ran into some of that. We used a professional videographer that had experience videographing children, and we had two cameras. One was on the child of interest, and one was on the actual setting. We had microphones were very important in terms of fixed and linears. We paid them cash at the end of the filming, and we had time code on both cameras. We also had a variety of meals because we told parents that they could pick the meal they wanted us to videotape. Most of them picked the evening meal, but we did have some lunch, and one family, breakfast was the only time that they actually really sat down to eat together. So here's just an example of how the video setup looked. We had camera one on the setting, camera two was on the actual child, and we had time codes so that we could use that when we were actually evaluating the videos. And here's another video that I'll play for you. It may take just a little minute to show, so you get kind of a feel of how it actually looked.
Well, come here, let me see how it's playing. That's what Willow got last night. So it's a word game, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
Box of tapes.
Okay. And then, let me go down here. So each video, we told the parents that we wanted to video them getting a meal ready, eating, and then about 30 to 45 minutes post-meal, so that we could see if children came back and wanted to get more food, etc. But the videos ranged in length then from about 35 minutes, which was a very, very quick meal, to about 120 minutes. The average length was about an hour and 20 minutes. The two of us viewed the videos through using Google Hangout at that time. Now, of course, it's not called Hangout, but we looked at the videos together and we did it in 5-minute segments for each video. And we identified which of the instruments, items that we thought could be evaluated by looking at that 5-minute clip. We also considered what was captured by video and what actually wasn't captured, such as the absence of a behavior. And here's just another video I want to show you. Let's see, I've got to get to the right screen here.
Don't, you're going to... Now use your spoon and try your corn. Can you do that for me? Use your spoon and try your corn. You want help with your corn?
No.
Do you want help with it or can you do it? Can you be a big girl and do it? Try your corn, please. You remember? You have to try. Don't. Callie Elizabeth, you don't eat like that. What did I tell you? They tell you at school you have to try everything on your plate. You like it.
So I'm showing you this also to show you that we really feel that we had good involvement. We had videos where cats were crawling all over the table, where parents were talking about other people at their work. One family actually made their child sit at the table for 45 minutes in order to get the grapes that the child wanted. It was quite an educational experience. What we did then, like I said, is we had these 5-minute intervals, and this was for example, on the column here on the right, this was the item that we felt could be coded in these intervals. And we used that, and we found that every video had lots of different items that could be coded. In fact, each item, the number of 5-minute segments per item actually ranged from about 36 to 87, and 12 of the items had 52 codable segments. 6 items had 62 codable segments. So these videos were really captured what we were trying to be able to code. So then tier 2 was we had expert coders. We had 3 people that were trained and had used and had been involved a lot with the SATR Division of Responsibility. And we had them code these independently. And then tier 3 of our analysis was to actually determine the coder congruence and come up with a response then that we would say, that experts would say, upon viewing this video, this is what the parent could have said or should have said when they about this particular item. And then in tier 4 was we actually compared the coder, what the coder response was, with what the parents had responded when they first did the survey. So a coder got a sheet that looked like this, where they had a video and they were told these are the time codes to go look at on the video. And so they had this for each one of the items, each one of the 15 items. So, for example, this item, I let my child eat until she or he stops eating and doesn't want anymore. This was just a part of this. This is what the 5-minute segments were for each of these different video numbers. And then the coder came up with an overall item of what they felt the parent should have said by this. We had them make notes so that we were kind of seeing where they were coming from. We had in-depth coder training where, you know, we had them looking at 2 or 3 other videos to make sure there was some congruence. We did post-coding contact if we had questions. And every coder had the videos done in a unique order, except for the very first one. This way, we were addressing the idea of video fatigue. And coders had a period of time in which they could get these done so they could do them at their convenience. Then we looked at coder congruence, and we had a schema for what was considered strong or moderate congruence, only some congruence or inadequate. So, for example, if for a particular item, all the coders gave the same response, or 2 of them had the same response, but they were only dissimilar by 1 of the items, such as 2 coders said often and 1 said sometimes, we considered that to be strong congruence. So you can see that there was about nearly 90% of the decisions were strong or moderate congruence. And so then the tier 4 was looking at the coder consensus item this would be for one particular SDOR item, looking at video number 10. The coder said consensus was never, but the parent said often. So that was not a match at all. For video number 102, the coder consensus was always and the parent consensus. The parent said always, so that was considered to be a match. An agreement was when there was just one difference between one response option difference between the parent and the coder. So like video 113, the coder consensus was often, the parent said sometimes. So we consider that to be agreement. It wasn't a match, but it was an agreement. And we did that for every single one of the 15 items. And so we had a validation algorithm. We had 3 different methods. So, for example, if there was an agreement for at least 80% of the videos for each item, that item was considered valid. If there was a match plus agreement for at least 65% of the videos, that item was considered valid. And we had 2 other algorithms depending upon some of the items lent themselves to either a yes or a no option. And in this case, at least 80% of the videos had to have a parent coder match. And there was one category where it was compelling evidence, and that was sometimes where the parents reported a social desirable behavior, but it wasn't able to be viewed by the coders. And that's always often because we only, you know, viewed one particular meal. So when we looked at this, then these were the 15 items. There were three items that were not considered valid. Might try to make my child taste everything that is prepared. In this case, the parents said, you know, what was, you know, socially acceptable, which was, yes, I try to make my child taste everything. Because we incorrectly feel that it's really important to make children taste things, which is absolutely not correct. And it's not congruent at all with the division of responsibility. Also, I try to make my child eat everything on his or her plate. Parents knew that wasn't very good. Many of them said that there was just such a problem with observing that and what parents said. It didn't match at all. And then the idea about snacks, because we only did meals, we were not really able to analyze the snack item. So we removed those three items. The other ones were all valid. And we ended up then with a 12-item survey that we now move forward to looking at the construct validity of the 12-item survey. And that's actually the article that is published in the Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior. So the recruitment was from WIC clinics and many low-income venues. The survey was done online, although we did have paper options available, and a few people did use the paper options. The survey set included quality of life, pediatric quality of life, the also measured stress, eating behavior, parent eating competence, parent feeding style, the child feeding questionnaire. We measured sleep with the Pittsburgh Sleep Quality Index, general health questionnaire, and we also measured dietary intake. What we also had then was the child nutrition risk, which was measured with the NutriStep scale. And the NutriStep scale has been heavily tested and validated in Canada, and it is used across Canada. You obtain it from the University of Guelph. And it is 17 items, and they assess four risk factors. They assess dietary intake, physical growth, physical activity, and influences on eating behavior. And they have done a lot with the scoring. The scores can range from 0 to 68. And if there's a score of 20 or less, they indicate that the child has no nutrition risk. If there's a score of 21 to 25, it's a moderate nutrition risk. Or scores greater than 25, high nutrition risk. And like I said, they have done a lot of research to validate this particular scoring and looking at the sensitivity and the specificity of the scoring. So we were interested in comparing the SDOR responses from the 12 items with the NutriStep, as well as with these other surveys that were administered at the same time as the SDOR was given. I will say that the SDOR was given first in the online survey set, so that we weren't going to be having problems with interpretation of answers based upon reading all kinds of other questions, such as in the child feeding questionnaire or parent feeding style. We know that as you're going through a long survey, what you have to answer first can influence what you answer later. So the SDOR was given first in the survey set. So looking at the results, the SDOR mean score was 25.9. The rank score ranged from 16 to 32. The possible scores are 0 to 36. And higher scores mean greater adherence to the SATR division of responsibility. And so when we look at the NutriStep responses, we found that there were 70 people that had a low nutrition risk, and there were 28 that were at moderate to high risk. There were only two people that had high risk, and so we collapsed them together with the moderate risk. So there were 28 that, by the NutriStep scale, they would have been labeled as moderate to high nutrition risk. And so we looked at what was the SDOR score. And we found that there was a statistically significant difference between the SDOR score for those at low risk versus moderate to high risk. And when we controlled for low income status, it continued to stay statistically significantly different. So the SDOR score also correlated with the NutriStep score, a 0.43 correlation. The higher the NutriStep score, the greater the nutrition risk, and the lower the SDOR score, the greater the less the adherence to SDOR. So that's why there's the inverse negative correlation. We found that each 1 point increase in SDOR decreased the odds by 21% of being in moderate or high risk on NutriStep category. And if the SDOR adherence is denoted as a score of 24 or greater, then there's not a high sensitivity. It's only 0.29, but there's a very high specificity. And of course, what that means then is that there are not a lot of false positives. If the SDOR adherence is a cutoff score is 26 or more, then the sensitivity increases to be pretty equal to the specificity, where both of them are about at the two-thirds mark. And so at this time, we've begun looking at the scoring, and of course, we want to do a lot more with the scoring in terms of which is the best cutoff to use. Right now, we tell people to use the cutoff that works for what they're trying to do. Are they trying to decrease false positives in terms of nutrition risk, or are they trying to decrease false negatives in terms of nutrition risk? And the goal that you're using is going to determine the actual cutoff that you're going to do. In fact, what we're hoping to do is utilize to do some future research that we're planning right now that will utilize what WIC considers to be nutrition risk. You know, this is all based upon the Canadian NutriStep nutrition risk level, and we'd like to administer this survey to people who are in WIC and who complete the other requirements of surveys and analyses and evaluations for WIC, and to see if the relationship still holds with the WIC-defined nutrition risk level, and if so, what is the actual scoring for that? So what does this actually mean? It means that adherence to SDOR can be measured, it can be tracked, it can be applied to counseling plans. It can actually be applied to implementation decisions. And we also were able to show, because we had the video families complete the SDOR one more time, which was before there was any videotaping, we were able to look at test-retest reliability. And we found that the repeat measures were correlated at 0.71. The average score at time one was 26.8, and the average score at time two was 26.4. And the tests were taken anywhere from 1 to 16 weeks apart. There were a couple that were done 3 or 4 months later. Most of them, more than 80% of them, were done within 1 to 2 weeks apart. This also shows that SDOR captures the theoretical underpinnings of SDOR. We were able to show in a factor analysis that there were 5 factors. They accounted for 59% of the variance. One of the factors was mealtime structure, and this relates to parent leadership. So the item, when I'm at home at mealtimes, I sit down and eat with my child, fit into mealtime structure. Another one factor was what is available to the child to eat. Parent leadership with feeding, I make something special for my child when she or he won't eat. Now, again, this is one of those questions that would be reverse scored, but it's worded in a way that the parent can agree with it if they do it. We don't want to waste a lot of cognitive executive function having parents try to feel that they have to disagree with the question. Parent leadership with feeding, how food is available. We have food left over after meals that fit into that factor, into that category. Then there were 2 that related to child autonomy, respect for the child autonomy in eating, which is I struggle to get my child to eat. Also, the factor of who controls what, when, or how much is eaten. I let my child eat until she or he stops eating and doesn't want anymore. And so the factor structure really worked out very nicely in terms of looking at the tenets of SDOR. And, of course, this is something that we'd like to look at further so that perhaps when a parent takes the survey, maybe their low score is really related to one of these particular factors. And so you as a clinician or an educator can know exactly which items you need to focus on in terms of your counseling or your education. Another thing is that the congruence with other validated measures offered evidence that following the Satter division of feeding, of responsibility in feeding, is really the best practice framework. So adherence to SDOR was associated with less stress using the Cone stress scale, better sleep quality, less cognitive restraint in eating, with being eating competent, and with parents using less restriction in feeding, also using less pressure to eat. Again, these are from the child feeding questionnaire. And looking at feeding styles, when non-adherence was defined as a score of greater than or equal to 26, when we use that as a cutoff, the authoritarian parents had actually had more children at nutrition risk than parents that use other feeding styles. And that's one thing that, we talk about is that the authoritarian parenting style isn't compatible at all with SDOR. And we know that there are a lot of problems with children feeding. And so we were actually able to see this when we used 26 or greater as a cutoff for whether or not you were adhering to SDOR. So I'm just presenting this as, even though we've been working on it for 12 years, it's initial research. We feel very comfortable with the 12 items, that they're understood, that they're items that really measure what we're intending for them to measure. They're very valid. We feel the survey is reliable. But going forward then, looking at what Messing talks about with validation, you're never done with validation ever. And we really would like to have more research done with the SDOR instrument. And also looking at how it fits with the United States standards for nutrition risk, and looking at the factor structure and looking at the scoring. Because this would really be helpful to be able to have this instrument, which really takes like 3 minutes for a parent to complete and written at the second to third grade reading level, and to be able to have them complete that. And then to be able to know, to triage, and to be able to better use our resources for counseling and education to the people that will best benefit from it. And so we just encourage you to look it up, to ask us questions about it, to be able to indicate your interest in using this for research and for practice. So I guess I am... I'm open now to questions, and hope that you will get in touch with me if you think of questions even after the webinar. My email is here on the screen, and feel free to get in touch with me. So, Georgiana, are there any questions to ask?
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I don't see any questions right now. As a reminder, you are welcome to submit some questions if you have something to ask. We'd love to hear from y'all.
I'd be happy to go back and explain anything related to the way we did the video testing and the way we looked at color congruence or anything like that. There were lots of rules and regulations, lots of training involved, but a little bit too much to put into one PowerPoint. If any of you are doing video research, you know, of course, that this is difficult to do, and that you need to have all of these rules and regulations set ahead of time so that you aren't influenced by some of the things that you're finding, that you know exactly what your goals and objectives are. And the same with some of your congruence to between coders. What would you consider to be coders being congruent or not? You don't want to kind of make that up as you go along. I have actually used some of this work in my I teach a research methods class in showing students how, you know, doing video research is very useful and important, but you have to have some strategies developed ahead of time.
What were some of those strategies that you had for coder congruence?
Well, what we did was if there was one coder that was entirely opposite than the others, we had a rule that we could contact that coder to ask them more about why they coded the way they did. And because we know that sometimes people get confused and are meaning to put down always when they put down never, just because of the opposite version. And indeed, there were a couple of times where one coder wrote down never and the other two coders said always. And so we contacted her and just said, we'd like to talk with you about the way you coded video 115 on, you know, FD on the item, 12. And your comment that you made doesn't really fit with the code that you gave, but we'd like to understand it a little bit more. And most of the time the coder said, oh, yeah, I guess I should have put down always. I don't know why I put down never. And so we had that ahead of time, that rule ahead of time. That was the only time that we would contact the coders was when there was something that was really divergent. We also knew that because what means sometime to one person means often to another, we had done some earlier work with participants to find out what does sometimes mean to them, what does often mean to them, to make sure that there was enough difference in the response options that we could use those particular response options. But we knew that we hadn't tested that with our coders. And so we made the understanding ahead of time that if they were one off, that we were not going to consider that to be real different, because it would not be, it would be possible that sometimes a coder would say rarely and another coder would sometimes is the same as rarely. And indeed, we're glad that we did that, because we did have many times where two coders agreed, but one coder was one response option off. And so looking at how you're going to have agreement among your coders, for us, that was important that we did all of those rules ahead of time, and that they were rules that we didn't share with anybody else. The coders had no idea really what we were going to do. They just knew they were looking at a video. They were looking at for items. They picked out an item. They looked at the videos for that item. They looked at the time, the 5-minute intervals. They decided how they would have scored it, how they felt the parent could have scored it. And like I said before, each coder had the videos listed in a different order, and they were told to do the videos in the order in which they were on their coding sheet, because we do know that sometimes there can be, people can just score something differently the very first few times they see a video. And then by the time they get to the last one, they have 20 videos, they may have some fatigue, or they may be tired of looking at something, or they may be assuming something because they saw something similar in two or three earlier videos. So we did have all the videos all in a different order, except for the first one, so that we could compare what they said and did for the very first video, make sure there was congruence, and we only let them continue after we had the very first video that they all did at the same time.
Awesome. We do have three questions. The first one is, any plans for conducting research in children with type 1 diabetes or other chronic dietary issues?
I don't have plans for that, although I think that's an excellent idea. I know that the Division of Responsibility, Ellen Satter, has addressed that a lot in some of her materials regarding children that have diabetes and chronic conditions or some disabilities. So I think that would be fabulous if somebody has access to a sample. I'd be very happy to talk with you and to be involved in either helping you get that off the ground or to actually doing that research myself or with my lab.
Awesome. We also had another question. How did you set the environment so that the parents would be comfortable and honest during the filming? I also had this question. I was pretty amazed how comfortable they were.
Okay. Yeah, well, a couple of things. First of all, we did do a pre-video visit so that the parents met the videographer, they met the researcher, and the videographer and researcher were in the home for a while. They didn't just go there and be there for 10 minutes. They were in there for a while. They actually set up a couple of cameras to see how it would look, how it would work. They had them sitting there for a while. They did a lot with telling the parent, we are not grading you in any way, shape, or form. There's no right or wrong way to what you do. How you look at your family's doing well, it's successful. Your children are functioning, they're growing. So whatever you're doing is well. We want to see what you typically do. And so parents, we told them not to make any special foods. If their children didn't eat and threw the dish across the room, we really didn't care. So there was a lot of discussion with them to have them feel comfortable about the fact that all we wanted to do was to see a typical family meal for them. And I do feel that the videographer was had done a lot of family, school-age children, young children videos. He was very good about being discreet. When the meal was going on, the cameras were running, but nobody else was in the room. The videographer, the researcher left. So the family knew that there was the camera there, but there was nobody listening to them, et cetera. And also on the day of filming, they came ahead of time, talked with the parents, set things up, and had the cameras rolling well before the meal even started. In fact, we really tried to capture meal preparation so that we could see, was the child complaining of being hungry? Did the parent feed the child before the meal? And so by the time they sat down to the meal, they were very unaware. And then we did ask a debriefing survey. We did ask 7 questions, and one of them was, how aware of the camera were you at the beginning of the meal? And how aware of the camera were you at the end of the meal? And there was only one family that indicated that they were as aware at the end of the meal as they were at the beginning. All the other families indicated they were much less aware. Some even said, I forgot the camera was even there. And I will say that by some of the questions and some of the responses that happened during the meal, we know that the parents forgot about the camera being there. I will say that when we submitted the manuscript to the Academy, the Nutrition Journal of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, I had very clearly described why we knew that the parents were unaware of the camera, and the reviewer and the editor told me that I had to remove that because I had to just a second here that I had to remove that. There might be somebody that would be able to, there might be able to be somebody that would identify when they're, who they were and who the person was. So it was very, you know, they were that specific that I actually had to take that information out. The family would, and people would have recognized themselves.
Huh. That's really interesting. Thank you. I appreciate that. We also had one more question. It said, thank you. Can you elaborate on the demographic breakdown of your sample?
The sample was, I don't have that memorized, but I know that from, for example, in the videos, we had a preponderance of white females. We did have a couple of families that were of color, being a black or a Hispanic, and there was one family that had some Native American background. We do know that on the families that agreed to be videotaped, the most of them were receiving, were participating in SNAP or WIC, and we did a heavy recruitment from WIC. But as far as the survey goes, again, a large number of them were, most of the people are from central Pennsylvania, and so they were white. And but a large number of them were, again, participating in WIC or SNAP. And I think that's another, you bring up a really good point, whoever asked that question, that it would be really great to redo the study with a sample with different demographic base. I think that's really important. And we do note that that's one of the limitations of our study, was that they were from, you know, central Pennsylvania. They were mostly white. They were low income, from mostly low income families. And so looking at a different sample would make the survey results much more generalizable, which of course would be something that'd be really good.
Awesome, thank you. I don't see any more questions unless anyone has anything else to submit.
Well, I can go ahead and do our closing housekeeping just in case. Just a reminder, there's a short survey when I close the webinar. Appreciate your feedback on this session as well as ideas for future webinars. I'm sure the Children's Division would appreciate any ideas. Thank them very much. I thank them very much for organizing this program today. And then watch for an email probably end of the day on Monday. With a link to the recording, your CEU certificate, and your handout. And then just a reminder, Journal Club is still ongoing, so please check the SNEB website for upcoming webinars. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that abstracts are also being accepted for the 22 conference, which Barbara is chairing. We are hoping and planning to meet in person in Atlanta next July. But abstract presenters will have the option to present in person or virtually. So we encourage you to share your research through the conference abstract process. So thank you for joining the webinar today.
Thank you.